Yes, hello and good day. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKW's independent international news show. And I am your host, Scott Price. Excuse me. Today is April the 5th, 2013. And on today's show, it will be an interview I just did. I just finished it up just a little while ago. Let's turn that down a bit. I did an interview with Nick Barry Shaw. He's an independent researcher. He's a member of Canada-Haiti Action Network. He's also the co-author of Paved with Good Intentions, Canada's Development NGOs from Idealism to Imperialism. And so he's going to be an interview with him talking about CETA. As you may have heard, what has happened is that the Conservative government in their most recent budget that they tabled just last week, I believe, has kind of rolled in CETA, Canadian International Development Agency, into a new agency called the Department of Foreign Affairs. It's a Department of... There's a new name for it. Let me just pull it up here on my notes. Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade, and Development. So CETA was actually created in 1968, and so basically it's Canada's aid and development infrastructure. That's kind of what they do. So this has gotten some attention from some people. On the one hand, the Conservatives are basically saying, well, no, this isn't... This has nothing to do... this is just a natural evolution. I think Julian Fantino, Minister of International Cooperation, said, this is not a signal of revolution. It is part of a natural evolution. So that was his little take on that. And there's other people from the NGO community who are saying, well, now this CETA is going to be losing any of its kind of independence and that kind of thing, and that this is all part of Conservative government's general move away from this kind of stuff, from aid and from those so-called Canadian peacekeeper type of things. So that's kind of been what this discussion has been so far, from what I can tell. I think there's been some more dissenting articles here and there, but Nick Barry Shaw will be on to talk about... He'll be giving a good overview of CETA and Canadian aid development and development agencies and things like that from the 50s to now, and how, interestingly, he says, you know, this isn't any kind of a rapid departure from what has happened before. CETA really wasn't all that independent to begin with. And so he gives a good critical analysis, which I think is important to sort of cut through what a lot of has already been said, because there hasn't been a lot of... There's been a lot of agreement. And very interestingly, there's been a lot of agreement even within all the present political parties. I know Thomas Mulcair said, well, you know, if the money flows better and if it's more efficient, then right on, right? Which is interesting coming from the leader of the NDP. The Liberals, I'm not entirely sure if they really said anything. Of course, being in the midst of a leadership run and leadership debates, perhaps that's why I haven't heard anyone from the Liberal caucus come out and really say this as good or bad either way. But perhaps they did, and I just didn't notice that. But anyways, that's going to be the show. We're going to be talking about Canada's aid and development and NGOs and things like that. So going to want to stay tuned for that, because Nick Barry Shaw gives some really great context to a lot of these issues. And it's not... I think to expand the debate a bit on this whole debate on Canadian foreign policy, which I think is a little too narrow in general. We'll have all of that, and of course, international news in brief. But first, just a little quick announcement, like I always like to say. Now, CKW is your listener-driven radio station on the FM dial here in Winnipeg. We take listener-driven very seriously. That means that not only are you supporting us right now, but we depend on your pledges every February during Fund Drive. So because of this, this listener-driven aspect of it, I always like to get questions, comments, concerns from the listeners. You can contact me directly, which is not something that you can actually do for a lot of other radio stations, they usually have some sort of a filter, or, you know, they're screening people. But no, you can contact me directly with questions, comments. If you want, if there's an issue you think in terms of international news, you want to see some coverage, you can get a hold of me. So there's a couple ways you can do this. The on-air phone is the phone line is 204-774-6877. There's my email, warningshots.ckuw. Yeah, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. You also follow me on Twitter at warningshots. You can find me there. I also suggest, if you're going to follow me, follow CKUW on Twitter at CKUW. You can find about all the things that are happening on this fine station. So that is kind of what we do as far as listener driven. We like to have that interaction with you, the listener, because that is one of the most important parts about what we do, because we depend on you. But anyways, let's get going into some of the news that's happening around the world right now with your international news in brief. So let's go to that right now. All right, now here is some of the news that's going around the world right now. AllAfrica.com reports thousands of pastoralists in northern Tanzania are protesting against a government move to expand the amount of land it leases to foreign investors because they will no longer be able to graze animals there in the dry season. A civic leader in the area told Alternate the government is using double standards to grab more village land and lease it to Dubai-based Ortello Business Corporation, or known as the OBC, which runs game hunting safaris. Other investors are also said to be interested in renting land in the region. Maasai herders in the district who rear cattle for a living accuse the government of using wildlife conservation as a pretext to evict them from their land. They say the underlying aim is to further the commercial interests of companies that want to take over the 15,000 square kilometers area for hunting and tourism. Under legislation introduced in 1999, all the land in the region is classified as village land. However, a portion of village land and so-called game-controlled area has been leased to the OBC since 1992. Until the 2009 Wildlife Conservation Act, the designation of a game-controlled area has no bearing on how land was used or managed, but the law prohibits farming and livestock grazing in those areas. And weekly news update on the Americas reports two or more men on a motorcycle shot and killed Haitian journalist and political activist Jorge Horat on the evening of March the 23rd in the front of his home in the north of Port-au-Prince. The National Police of Haiti spokesperson said on March the 24th that there are still no suspects for the murder. The police have also not determined a motive for the murder. The victim was receiving threats, anonymous phone calls, according to Ives Joseph, a administrator for Honorat's newspaper, Haiti Progress, a weekly published in Port-au-Prince in Brooklyn. Horat was the editor-in-chief of the paper, which was started in 1983 as a leftist weekly fighting the dictatorship of Jean-Claude Duvalier. Honorat was a longtime member of the editorial team headed by the paper's founder, former Haitian ambassador at large, Ben Dupuis. But the two men fell out later. Horat also had a leadership position in the small National Popular Party in the Haitian legislature. At the time of his death, he was working as a consulate at the office of the prime minister in the government of the right-wing president right now. And also, Intercontinental Cry reports the Awa peoples have issued another appeal to the Brazilian government urging the immediate eviction of loggers, ranchers, and settlers who have illegally occupied the Awa's forest homelands northeast of the country. According to the Survival International, a federal judge previously ruled that the government must remove the invaders by the end of March 2013. However, not a single person has yet to be evicted. The Awa are becoming increasingly desperate as the illegal loggers continue to close in on them and settlers continue to encroach on the territory, says Survival International. A government survey estimates there could be up to 4,500 invaders, ranchers, loggers, and settlers occupying just one of the Awa's four territories, whose own population stands at just over 450. And that is some of the news happening around the world right now. Do stay tuned for an interview with Nick Barry Shaw about Canada CETA being rolled into the Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade, and Development, and what that means for Canadian foreign policy, aid, and development. That's all on Warning Shots. Stay tuned. This is Warning Shots on CKW 95.9 FM. Yes, and we are back. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKW's independent international news show. I'm your host, Scott Price, and you just heard a track from The Burning Hell. Really great band off the album TikTok called I Love the Things That People Make. And if you're a CKW listener, you will recognize that song as that was the old theme song for a little show called Radio Free World, which used to occupy this spot in this and the content of international news hosted by the then news director, Jeffrey Young, who is now off in Peru doing Lord knows what, but he's off in Peru. Anyways, I was listening to that listening to The Burning Hell lately, and I really do love that song, and brought back fond old memories of when I first started here at the station, and the zaniness that was Jeffrey Young. Anyways, but back to the content of the show. So as I said at the top, this is an interview with Nick Barry Shaw. He's an independent researcher and a co-author of the book Paved with Good Intentions, Canada's NGOs from Idealism to Imperialism. Very critical look at Canada's development NGOs and aid and how that works and how that's set up. So I thought Nick would be a good person to talk to bring some more context into this whole thing about CETA being rolled into Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development, and what that means. So this is the interview I just did with Nick Barry Shaw just this morning, talking about CETA, Canadian foreign policy, aid and development, and all that kind of stuff. So without further ado, here is Nick Barry Shaw and myself talking about those issues. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
So now just to catch everyone up, so the Conservatives have announced in the budget that CETA will be merged into this new Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development. So essentially it's rolling CETA into Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Now, this has caused, I guess, a bit of discussion, but I mean, one thing we'll probably touch on too is the lack of any real range of discussion on this issue. But it seems that people are sort of framing it in being, you know, either a good thing, that this is going to make things more efficient and we're going to spend taxpayers' money better by doing this. Other people are saying, well, no, this is not the Canadian way, I suppose, is one way of putting it, that, you know, these development NGOs and how we do aid and development is important, and how we did this previous is far better than what the Conservatives are doing now. But I think the place to start this whole discussion, though, is when CETA was actually established in 1968 and the context of that. So, Nick, can you explain a bit about how when CETA was established in 68 and what was going around in both in North America and the world at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually bring it back a little further, to the 1950s with the origins of Canada's aid program as such. It started in 1950 with the Colombo Plan, which was an aid program for India and other parts of South Asia. And, Canada's aid program was really born out of the Cold War and out of concerns that places like India in Asia would kind of go the same route as China, and it would be lost to communism, you know, as if India was ours to lose, but that's a whole other story. And so one of the things that's interesting there is that kind of from the beginning, Canada's aid program was tied up with these geopolitical imperatives and a kind of concern to keep Western nations, or rather nations in the Third World, within the Western orbit. And studies of Canada's early aid program really kind of just show this over and over again, that on the one hand, you had these geopolitical interests that were very deeply informing how Canada gave aid. And on the other hand, you had economic interests, the desire of the Canadian government to open up new markets for its exporters, to create new opportunities for multinational corporations to invest in the global south, and so on. And so really from the beginning, Canada's aid program was not pure. It was not disinterested. It was always political. And so even, before we get up to the founding of CETA in 1968, we see that it wasn't the humanitarian enterprise that it's often presented as. So for me, I find the idea that, we can go back to the good old days kind of ridiculous, because there never were any good old days.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important point of taking it back to the 50s too. But now in 68, though, when CETA was actually, created as such, I mean, you also in 68, I mean, there's quite a bit going on here. You have, there's anti-war movement, There's feminism, there's the civil rights movement in the United States. You have also this, related to that, is this decolonization movement going on, I mean, in Africa and stuff like that. How does that also affect how CETA and development was created early on?
Yeah, and just connecting to that, the Canada's aid program for the Colombo Plan and then the organization that followed it, the External Aid Office, which was founded in 1960, these were directly under the Minister of External Affairs. And so it's kind of funny because we're basically going back to the Pearson days when aid was directly a part of the foreign policy decision-making apparatus. In 1968, this changed a bit, not entirely, but it did change a bit. Where CETA was, the External Aid Office was transformed into CETA and given its own little organizational structure, but it was still under the Minister of External Affairs. So it had a kind of separate organizational, diagram, but it was still ultimately responsible to the Minister of External Affairs. Now, why this changed? I think a lot of the context you were alluding to is precisely why there was a need externally. To present Canada's aid as disinterested, as following these kind of objective, development needs, right, and not flowing from kind of political or economic imperative of Canada's foreign policy. And so to have credibility with a very rapidly decolonizing third world, I think the government at the time, the Trudeau government, kind of judged this necessary, right? And then on the other hand, within Canada, to kind of present development to the public as an enterprise that wasn't associated with the Cold War and wasn't associated with advancing the interests of Canadian corporations abroad. And that was important, too, because, as you mentioned, there were anti-war movements in Canada, and there was a broader kind of left internationalist movement coming together within Canada, and that was increasingly critical of the way Canada was very closely aligned with the U.S. and was using its aid program really to advance corporate interests abroad. And so that was the context in which I think CETA was kind of rendered independent from, or, nominally independent from the foreign aid, foreign policy bureaucracy.
I kind of like your point about how we're not, this current conservative move is actually going back to how it was originally done under Pearson, right? And that's interesting because Pearson is seen as this great, the hallmark, I guess, of Canadian internationalism and diplomacy, right? So that's I think that's a pretty interesting historical point, right?
Yeah.
Now, in talking more recently, though, in terms of aid and development, I think it's interesting that there's also between the three parties now, my understanding, though, is that I'm not sure what the Liberals have said about this. I know Thomas Mulcair, the leader of the NDP, said, well, this will be good if money can flow better and it can be more efficient. So the NDP weren't even, as far as I know, that critical, although I'm not sure what maybe other people in the caucus were saying. But I haven't heard, it's interesting that from the opposition parties, I haven't heard much from them. Is it because really that they're not that far off from one another, between the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the NDP? They're not very far off from one another, and the difference is mostly tactical? Is that what's going on there?
I think so. I think exactly what's happening this is not, as some have presented it, especially people from the development NGO sector, they've kind of presented this as, a continuing Harper attack on Canadian values as such, just another manifestation of the Harper assault on Canada. And what you see is that, at least amongst Canada's foreign policy elite, from all sectors, they're 100% agreed, it seems like, on this policy change, And I think that reflects a kind of deeper consensus amongst the foreign policy elite that the kind of facade of independence that CETA was given back in 1968 is no longer useful, And it's no longer useful because we don't need to go around in the third world pretending that we're doing neutral, apolitical development anymore, and we can kind of more baldly throw around our weight. And I think we see that very clearly with the mining company NGO partnerships, where CETA is funding Canadian development NGOs to do these kind of projects around the sites of these huge open pit mines in order to buy off local community opposition to these projects and in order to kind of rehabilitate the image of the mining corporations at home and let a bit of the humanitarian aura of these NGOs kind of rub off on the reputation of these corporations that has been rather sullied lately, and with good reason. So I think it's part of a longer process. That's something that's been going on really, I would say, since the 80s, and really picked up steam under the Liberals. Probably the clearest example of that would be the 3D kind of approach to foreign policy, as it was dubbed under Paul Martin. The idea of coordinating development, diplomacy, and defense into one integrated kind of policy, and which was applied most clearly in Afghanistan, and where development aid was really made a part of the counterinsurgency war that Canada was fighting there against Afghans. And so it's a continuation, and I think the conservatives are really right about that, and the people who support this are right about that, that this isn't a radical break. It is an evolution of an already existing trend.
Yeah, one of the points, one of the quotes I went and reading about this, Julian Fantino, the Minister of International Cooperation, said in the Globe and Mail article, op-ed, that he got at the end, he said, "This is not a signal of revolution. It's a part of a natural evolution." So I think that kind of sums it up pretty well, right? Now, I think also too. I mean, let's talk a bit about. You talked about the outcry from some people from in the development NGO world, but your book, Paid with Good Intentions, really puts a really critical eye on NGOs, and I think it's important for people for this issue to hear this sort of a criticism of development NGOs and how, they're not, not all what they're cracked up to be. So I guess maybe going more into the topic of your book that you co-authored, Paid with Good Intentions, what is sort of the problem with this NGO model?
The problem with NGOs is pretty straightforward. It can be summed up as they're not non-governmental. That's the big problem, right? They present themselves as being these independent kind of organizations who are driven by humanitarian goals, but in reality, they receive on average about 60% of their funding from the now defunct CETA, and will continue to get their funding from the new organization that's being created within foreign affairs. And so that is kind of the main contradiction that we explore in this book, which is the kind of outward presentation of these organizations being independent and not associated with the state, and the reality of the fact that they get a huge amount of their budget, often a majority of their budget, from the government, and the consequences that that has for how they operate.
Now, I think though it's something that the CKW listeners, I think, are a bit familiar with, because we've done quite extended coverage of this problem, of the example of Haiti. So could you give an example what's going on in Haiti of where they're not actually non-governmental at all?
Yeah. Haiti was the reason Drew and I wrote the book. That was what got us really questioning this kind of mythology about the NGOs. And in Haiti, what you had is a coup d'etat in 2004, where the democratically elected government was overthrown by Canada, the U.S., and France. And you had 2 years of really bloody and terrible repression against overwhelmingly the poor neighborhoods of the capital, Port-au-Prince, where people were protesting almost daily against the overthrow of their government. And it was in this context that we discovered not only were development NGOs in Canada not speaking out about the participation of our government in this really quite terrible foreign policy crime, they were actually actively profiting from it. They were getting millions and millions of dollars worth of contracts to do work in Haiti in support of the unelected government that had been installed after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's administration had been overthrown. And within Canada, and especially within Quebec, we found they were spreading all sorts of nonsense, saying that there was no coup that had happened, there were no human rights abuses happening in the country, everything was great since the government was overthrown, and so on and so forth. You know, flying totally in the face of, you know, one after the other human rights reports coming from Haiti, from independent observers, from truly independent observers, saying that the supporters of the overthrown government were being systematically persecuted, that there were being massacres that were happening in the poor neighborhoods, that every time people went out into the streets and demonstrated, the RCMP-trained Haitian police would go out and shoot people. These sorts of things, and they were saying this just wasn't happening. So I think that, for us, was a kind of really stark lesson in how this relationship, this financial relationship with the federal government that Canadian NGOs, Canadian development NGOs have, can really affect their politics. And so starting from that, we started asking ourselves, okay, well, if this happened in Haiti, you know, is it happening anywhere else, or is this just a freak occurrence? And unfortunately, it wasn't. This is part of kind of a deeper system.
Yeah, now, moving forward with this, I mean, because this is, you talk about these systematic problems, and I mean, going through the history of it, and then also now giving a more recent example of Haiti, I mean, you see this a systematic structural problem here on how these things are done. So, and also, I mean, you also see, as we just talked about too, between the political parties, there's pretty much agreement on the issues in a lot of ways. So what is the other way forward then with this, with aid and development and NGOs? And, you know, so is there another way of going about this stuff? What are other options to explore here?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I'm studying, part of my graduate studies right now, which is the kind of the history of labor internationalism and other kinds of internationalism, internationalisms that happen outside of government-funded channels. And there's actually a rich history here that that hasn't really been explored. In one particular case would be the Chile Solidarity Movement in the 1970s, where in Quebec, at least, the labor movement played a huge role, you know, and provided all sorts of support and was actively involved in the Chile Solidarity Movement and, amongst other things, forced the Trudeau government at the time in 1973, after there was a coup d'etat in Chile, to open the borders to, you know, Chilean trade unionists and socialists and communists who were being persecuted by this U.S.-backed military dictatorship, and actually managed to save quite a few lives, probably, as a result. And so there are examples like that, and I think one of the lessons that I draw, the obvious lesson, is that if you actually want to have any kind of influence on the Canadian government's foreign policy and you want to try to transform it, you need to be independent. And, I mean, working with the labor movement can be one way of doing that, or at least it was in the 1970s, and I think it potentially could be in the future. The church has played a really important role in this example. I think that could happen again. But it presupposes a kind of bigger struggle, you know. I think we can't really imagine Canada's foreign policy and his, you know, involvement in supporting mining companies abroad or overthrowing democratically elected governments like in Haiti or supporting the overthrow of these governments like in Honduras. We can't really imagine that changing unless we change the kind of hold that corporate power has over our politics more generally, you know. And unless we start challenging the austerity agenda that is being applied not only in these countries in the third world, but also within Canada itself, you know? And for me, I think that's the biggest thing that needs to change, is we need to see international issues as intimately bound up with the struggle at home. And when we start fighting on that basis and start fighting not only to change, you know, go from anybody but Harper kind of politics to a politics that is a little more serious and starts talking about challenging neoliberalism and corporate power within Canada as such, then I think we'll be moving in the right direction. And then I think we'll start to make real progress.
Well, I think I would agree with a lot of that. Just at the end here, because we were kind of talking about this before we started the interview about, you know, this very, very narrow spectrum of debate when we're talking about this. And I think this has come up through this discussion that we've just had about, you know, between the political parties, there's not that much difference. Even you read a lot of the commentary of it, it's a very, like you said, a very narrow spectrum between people of saying, well, no, this is the way forward, this is a natural evolution, or no, it was better before, we need to go back when things were good, or that kind of thing. And but yet there's that critical element of a critical analysis that's not in the debate, in what is ostensibly a democratic government, a democratic society, yet there's such a limited spectrum of debate. How does that also play into what you just talked about, of broadening this discussion and broadening these issues?
I think it means that if we want to have these discussions, we're going to have them in independent media. I mean, I think we're going to have them on radio stations like yours. I think we're going to have them on in magazines like Briar Patch or, the Dominion. And I think we need to consciously make an effort to support those organizations and those media efforts, because it's crucial that we have spaces where we can broaden the parameters of debate and not always work within this kind of assumption that, you know, Canada is just out there doing the best it can for the poor of the world, and if there's something wrong with its policy, well, we just need to sit down with the policymakers and have a rational discussion, you know, and just kind of talk it over with them and appeal to reason and morality, and suddenly things will change, you know, which is the assumption that I think a lot of development NGOs kind of predicate their politics on, you know, this assumption that we live in a liberal pluralist society, you know. And when we start to acknowledge that it's not just that our policymakers don't have the right information, you know, it's not just that they haven't been talked to by a well-meaning person, but that, in fact, they're representative of far more powerful interests in Canadian society, the mining companies, the banks, manufacturing industries, textiles, et cetera, that are operating in the third world and that have very deep interests in the third world, and that they're acting to protect those interests abroad, then we start moving towards a different kind of politics. Then we start kind of understanding that the problem is systematic, and it's about who wields power in our society more generally, and we start organizing on a totally different basis. And I think, unfortunately, from what I've seen, the NDP has given up this kind of perspective and has really accommodated to the kind of austerity and neoliberal worldview increasingly, especially under Thomas Mulcair, but I think this was going on before. And so I think, you know, we need to continue to seek out independent avenues to have these discussions and start working with independent groups and trying to gather our forces together, you know, and build something larger and to carry on the struggle. And we're not going to do that through the mainstream media. And we're not going to do that through the main parties, I don't think.
Well, no, I think that's that is a spot to leave it at. But thank you very much, Nick, for coming on and talking about this, because I think it's like we were saying, there's a lot of context missing to the debate as such. So I thank you for coming on and supplying that to our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
And that was my interview with Nick Barry Shaw on CETA being rolled into Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade, and Development. So talking wider about Canadian foreign policy and these other things. The book to check out is Paved with Good Intentions, Canada's Development NGOs from Imperialism. Anyways, Paved with Good Intentions is the main title of the book. I forget the long subtitle now. But that's off on, you can get that on Fernwood Publishing, actually. And so you can check that out. Also, if you go to ckwnews.ca, there is an interview and a little summary, about 10, 15 minutes, with Nick Barry Shaw when he was here in the fall for the DIY Anarchist Festival at the A-Zone, where he did a presentation on the book and where I originally met him. So go check that out as well. I mean, this interview will be posted on ckwnews.ca over the weekend, so you can also get that there. But now we're going to go to a couple of announcements and then some music, and then we're going to be closing out the show. But keep it locked here. This is Warning Shots on CKW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKW's independent international news show. I will be back in a moment.
CKUW is proud to present a special celebration of the life of longtime political activist Nick Turnette this Sunday, April 7th, starting at 1 p.m. at the West End Cultural Center, with performances by Fred Penner, 80 Sarah Kreindler, the Winnipeg Labour Choir, and more. Admission is free. Donations to the Nick Turnette Memorial Fund supporting social and environmental justice are welcome. For more information, contact Emily at 204-775-9327.
Hey, did you hear? CETA will create $12 billion in new wealth and put $1,000 into the pockets of every working family, which is equivalent to creating 80,000 new jobs.
That story has long since been discredited since its appearance in 2008. The estimate seems dubious, as it assumes hypothetical conditions like zero unemployment and total reinvestment of trade gains into new production that just aren't realistic.
So what's the reality?
Canada already has a trade deficit with the EU. In a relationship where we export raw resources and import high-value manufactured goods, CETA will reinforce this inequity.
For more information on CETA, visit www.canadians.org. Let me try again.
He was a pillar of industry. Well, God made some pillar, so some must filler be. Like me, a simple servant of the company, my humble tongue begins his eulogy. When only a small boy with no mother's love and no answers from the great dancer up above and no firm father to guide him, he watched a wild horse long to ride him. And legend has it that on that day he planted two tiny feet in that wild horse's way. That mighty stallion with a deathly eye, the stars looked down to watch a child die. But as the horse reared up to crush his tiny bones, its heart grew cold, cold as river stones. For it saw the steel in the soul of the child, and knew that no more would it run free and wild. And so our hero tamed his untamable horse. That was the beginning of his winning course. And from that moment till the end of his days, the people of this land would hear him say, it takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. From the farmer in the field to the spaceman in space, everybody has a reason, a purpose and place. Well, he was 10 when he started his first company. Less than 5 feet tall, but already somebody. By the time he was 16, he owned a warehouse block where he traded in trailers, trucks, lights, and livestock. Then came that famous day you all know. He went to buy a hacienda down in Mexico, Fell in love with the senora, begged her to get engaged. The main problem was she was three times his age. The other problem was she was already hitched to a real hijo de puta, a son of a bitch. They agreed to duel in the abandoned aeropuerto. The husband said, you can have her over mi cuerpo muerto. Our hero said, si esto no es muy difícil. And he shot so fast it looked like his hands were holding still. With his dying eyes the husband looked up to see the circling birds. And then he heard those famous words. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. From the farmer in the field to the spaceman in space. Everybody has a reason, a purpose and place. Story as well as I do, but I'll fill in the blanks now. At least I'll try to. He returned to his homeland with his aged bride, 400 laborers at his side. He said, I'll seize the knocking fists of opportunity and history. I shall build an empire of diligence and industry, shaped like a pyramid, all golden aglow, with my office at the apex and the others below. We all work together to build his dream in the swelter of the smelter and the sweat of the steam. Though many hands cramped and many muscles ached, oh, how we laughed on our coffee breaks. For we dreamed of the day when the work would be done. And at last it seemed that great day had come. The pyramid glistened like a golden fire. But he said, no, it's not high enough. It needs to be higher. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. From the farmer in the field to the spaceman in space. Everybody has a reason, a purpose and place. Now it's true that some grumbled and some were sure. Those famous words were simply a non sequitur. But with a soft sigh we went back to work for many years. Our families and fiancés collected their heartbroken tears. Till one day the unthinkable happened. Young Jose was high up on the scaffold. He screamed like a baby bird abandoned in a tree. Dios mío muchachos, you must come and see. There under the cyclops eye of the endless sun, we climbed the scaffolding, one by trembling one. Truly it was an evil sight to behold. There was our jefe imprisoned in gold, murdered with molten metal, now pinned there gruesomely, with only God's unblinking eye and of course us to see. We had to leave his body to the hungry birds, but deep in the pyramid's face we carved these words. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people to make a world. They say he was a pillar of industry. Well, God made some pillars, so some must filler be.
Yes, and we are back. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. I'm your host, Scott Price. And it's now 1:52 and we're getting to the end of the show. So we will go for a little close out of the show. But you just heard more from The Burning Hell. This is off their new album called People. And that was a song called Industrialists. And I really like this. Kind of started getting into The Burning Hell when after I came here at CKW, when I kind of found out about them and specifically Matthias, who's the main guy there. Really, it's really cool songwriting. He's pretty good songwriter, I think. Go check it out. New album called People. You can go check that out. And you can also, with the internet these days, you can also go to like Bandcamp and listen to past albums and that kind of stuff. But I recommend it. Check out The Burning Hell. So that brings us to the end of the show. Wonderful. So on today's show, you heard music from The Burning Hell as well. You heard from an interview I did with Nick Barry Shaw, co-author of Paved with Good Intentions, which is a critical look at Canada's development NGOs. And we were talking about CETA and CETA being rolled into this new Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Commerce and all that kind of stuff, and the effect that's going to have on Canadian aid, development, NGOs, what this means and how that's related to Canadian foreign policy. So ways to contact with questions, comments, concerns. There's a couple different ways you can do all that. Office phone number 204-786-9782. You can also get a hold of our news director, Michael Welsh, at cqwnews@rocketmail.com. There's my email address, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at warningshots. You can find me there. Also, I encourage you to follow CKUW. At CKUW on Twitter as well to find out all the things that are happening what we are broadcasting out of this fine little station. And there's a couple other things you can do. CKUW.ca is a great resource for listeners. You can get, if you go to the broadcast schedule, you can get free show archives, which you can get in a podcast kind of format. You can get it through iTunes, play it through a lot of different ways. So that's there. Also, check out ckuwnews.ca for featured stories and interviews from Warning Shots, as well as our local and more Canadian-centered content of People of Interest, which is our morning news show here at the station. So there's all sorts of different ways you can interact and enjoy the content that we supply for you here on CKUW. So that's the show for today. So next week, I'm not sure what's going to be on. Still, I want to do more stuff on stuff going on in Ethiopia that's still on the table. Hopefully, I'll have something for you guys next week. But at this point, I'm not sure. But that's something I've been following. So until that time, have a safe and fun weekend. Be kind to one another. And keep on tuning into CKW. We've got Mercy of Slumber coming up, Now Sounds, and Peg City Groove. So you want to keep it locked here. It's a great afternoon, Friday afternoon of music here on CKW. So keep it locked here. So have a good weekend and I will talk to you all next week. Bye-bye. And thanks for listening and supporting CKW.
Grab yourself a pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or a community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
Yeah, Yes, here is your community cupboard. Community information meeting, bus loop relocation. This is important. To make room for the United Health and Recplex at the U of W, the U of W transit bus route that used to loop onto our campus along Spence Street is being relocated. Our goal is to find a transit route that balances the need of the campus, neighborhood residents, local businesses, and Winnipeg Transit. Following a thorough assessment by the project team, two bus loops were determined to be viable. As a community member, you are invited to provide input that will help determine which of these two bus loops options will proceed. Please join us at a community information meeting at which representatives from U of Winnipeg, Winnipeg Transit, and Public Works will be on hand to answer questions. This is happening Wednesday, April the 17th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Magnus Eliason Recreation Center at 430 Langside Street. I'll just give that again. Wednesday, April 17th, 7 to 8:30, 430 Langside Street, Magnus Eliason Recreation Center. That's an important issue, so go check out that one. Also an announcement from St. George's Church. St. George's Church will be holding a giant garage sale Friday, April 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. and Saturday, April 20th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the corner of Grosvenor and Wilton Streets. From infant wear to vintage and everything in between, plus baking. That sounds like fun. So again, St. George's Church, that's at the corner of Grosvenor and Wilton Street. April 19th and Saturday, April the 20th. I don't have any more contact information, but there you go. And 2013 bicycle auction. The annual bicycle auction is happening. This is up to 250 bicycles tuned and ready to ride courtesy of Wrench Volunteers and Mechanics. So So this is happening Saturday, April the 27th, 7 to 8:45 a.m. public